As many of us do, I have sometimes an unclear reaction when I hear about a new book about Chicago. I wonder, will it be good? Will it be accurate? Will it say new things? Will it say true things about things that aren't new? And who are these people anyway, writing books about our city? Do they live here now? Were they born here? Were they born here and did they move away? Did they move here from somewhere else? We're Chicagoans. This is how we respond, and it may be how anybody responds to something in which he is invested or she is invested. When I heard about a book, The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream, I was terrible. I immediately had the reaction, well, there's a book I don't need to read. And I set my mind to that. I started noticing that it was getting reviewed, but then I started to notice that the reviews made the book sound very interesting. And then the author of the book and his book got attacked along with some other books in a very strange essay in the New York Times book review. And I thought, the enemy of my enemy, or words to that effect. If somebody's being attacked like that, they must be doing something right. And then a friend of mine said I was on an airplane. A lady had left a book. I picked it up. And it's a book about Chicago. And it has Kukla, Fran, and Ollie in it. And it has Studs Terkel in it. And it has Gwendolyn Brooks in it. It's an actual book about Chicago, the Chicago that we all know. I gave in. And I read the book, and I'm sure glad that I did. And then I met the author, Thomas Dyjah, D-Y-J-A. And in very short order, poor guy, we became friends. So I went from hating him without knowing him.
This explains a lot, Andrew, I have to say. Wondering why you would never answer our publicist's call, but now I know.
Now you know. Now you know. And so we are now today going to present to you not the last, but, the 200 or 300th media interview that Thomas Dyjah has done about The Third Coast. But the book's out in paperback now and from Penguin. So it's all the more reason to talk more about it. You may have seen and heard Tom in his many visits to Chicago to discuss the book and to discuss the history. It's the period from 1930 to 1960?
Yeah, 1937, 38 to 1960.
And rather than just walk through the book, which we could do, and we could do that for weeks and weeks because the book is pretty comprehensive, we're going to zero in on some of the most interesting things in the book and some of the most interesting things that Tom Dyjah does with the book. And I left out one very important element, and that is I went to a talk that Thomas Dyjah gave at the Arts Club of Chicago before I had met him. And it was a talk about something that when you sit down and think about it, seems completely logical. And I know of nobody, in this century at least, who observed this, let alone wrote deeply about it. And that is that the most famous structure on the Black South Side of Chicago, the Mecca, immortalized by Gwendolyn Brooks, by photographers, by memoirists, was on the exact spot and had the exact footprint as S.R. Crown Hall, designed by Mies van der Rohe for the new campus, the redeveloped campus that he directed of the Illinois Institute of Technology and the house that made modern architects as students. These two tremendous gifts of Chicago to the world, Black American urban civilization and culture, and modern international architecture, were all happening in one place. I go on about it at that much length because that capsule gives you an idea of what Thomas Dyjah does throughout the entire book. He goes in deep about the people we need to know more about, and he shows us ways that they were connected to things that we did not previously realize. And so even before we talk, I got to thank you already and salute you for this book. Welcome to Critical Thinking.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a long time coming, so I'm glad to be sitting down and with you.
Let's get some things clarified right now. You are from Chicago.
I am from Chicago.
Though you don't live here.
I don't. My mom still lives here. I was born on the Northwest Side, Belmont Cragen. In the house my father was raised in. I went to Gordon Tech. My mom grew up on the South Side in Evergreen Park. We were, from the 30s on, and the house that my grandfather built was in the middle of Prairie and all that sort of good stuff. So, yes, I still consider myself a Chicagoan. I went to Columbia in New York for college and went into the book business, and I stayed there. Married someone from New York, raised kids, and before I knew it, I'd been living in New York for 30 years. But it's been a great joy to come back to Chicago to rediscover it in a lot of profound ways, rediscover its past. I think it was, in a way, a search for my dad. This was the period that he lived in and grew up in mostly. And so it was a kind of discovering what that world I grew up in and knew about. It was like I'd grown up after this great party. Names like Bert Hillstrom and these people were, they were kind of back there, but they weren't on the scene anymore. And so it felt to me as if I'd missed all that. So that was one great part of it. But coming back these last years and being here more often, I also got to experience the city the way it is now. And it's a very different place than the Chicago I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And, and obviously different than the city I write about, in the Third Coast. So it's still reinventing itself.
One of the most important things I think that you do throughout the book, and I think when a listener reflects on the fact that you are from the Northwest Side, that you went to Catholic school, that you went to Gordon Tech, the Archdiocesan Lane Tech.
The late Gordon Tech.
Yes, now right, what has happened? It's no longer...
Well, DePaul got involved and gave it some really good support and sort of bucking it up, since when I was there, it was a 2,800 all-boys Catholic school. It was kind of a... resembled jail. They locked the door when the day started and you were not allowed outside, but it had, fallen, attendance has fallen down and to support it, DePaul got involved. But they basically took it over and got rid of all the Gordon Tech part of it. So those of us who are alumni are a little sad to be scraped out of the story. But, there we go.
Maybe because you came from a world that people from Polish and other ethnic backgrounds were very used to getting scraped out of stories. You are the guy from the Northwest Side who put black people back into Chicago history of the mid-century. We've had plenty of, quote, special studies and books about black history or biographies of individual people, but to hear most people who have taken the time to write books or who write columns or who live in other cities and tell people about Chicago, you absolutely would not know the real history of politics in the city in this period, 1938 or so to 1960, music, culture, art.
Well, it was very important to me to write about the city as one city. As you said, so often here's a book about Chicago and here's a book about black Chicago, as if these were on different continents, let alone different parts of the city. And so I really very much wanted to have a book that expressed all of these things working together. And to honestly write about either one, you have to be writing about them together. You can't write about Mies van der Rohe and IIT campus without getting into that neighborhood, without getting into the fact that Gwendolyn Brooks and the Mecca Flats are right there and just blocks away where the great blues clubs that produce the urban blues. These things are all working in concert. They're related to each other. So the book to me wasn't so much about doing original research. I stand on the shoulders of giants in that way. People have done that work. My job was to make these connections, juxtapositions of people being in the same place, influencing each other. And that was especially true with black Chicago. And one of the things that was, and there's more work to be done on this, and I know some people are doing it, is that in the 30s, there really was a period of a lot of interracial work together, coming out of the WPA, coming out of the John Reed clubs and that kind of socialist world, of the early 30s. But you had groups that were the Abraham Lincoln School, in the 30s. There was a much greater sense of hope. Drexel Square was a place that was known to be a kind of interracial area. So that was a real discovery. Having grown up in the Northwest Side at a very segregated time in a very segregated place, it was it kind of gave me a new kind of hope that there were these groups of people who really were defying what, in my experience of youthful Chicago, a very segregated place.
As there is at least one of those organizations and places that still exists and has existed continuously from its founding and continually too, let's dive in and start exploring some of these characters and some of these juxtapositions. I'm speaking of the Southside Community Arts Center.
Yeah, it's on South Michigan.
Right.
And it is the only surviving WPA project still working.
In the country.
In the country, yeah. Right. I mean, it really is living, breathing history. I was very lucky to talk to Dr. Margaret Burroughs before she passed. And that was really, you know, to sit down with someone who knew Richard Wright, who was, you know, Gwendolyn Brooks's great friend. It really, I was so glad to be able to talk to a number of people while they were still around to be able to get their stories about this.
So talk a bit about that period of Dr. Burroughs, of Gwendolyn Brooks, of Richard Wright, Langston
Hughes.
Well,
you know, that's a part that I wasn't, that's represented in the book, but I think is such a broad, and, you know, there's someone listening out there, who some grad student who's looking for a topic, this is it. You know, and there are people who are writing on the Black Renaissance, for sure, in Chicago, but there still deserves to be that book that's like that great book about Harlem that David Levering Lewis did. When Harlem was in vogue, there are so many important characters, African-American characters, but also whites who are working with them. Richard Wright is down there. Margaret Walker, who's a terrific major poet, is there. A lot of them come out of the John Reed Clubs, which were these kind of socialist meeting places that were set up for interracial meetings between artists. And when the WPA comes along, there are also many of them working together. Gwendolyn Brooks and Margaret Burroughs started their own little literary club called the Cree Lit Club. And Margaret Burroughs was kind of a cross between, I don't know, Nina Simone and Frida Kahlo or something. Mm-hmm. Very mm-hmm. fiery, very beautiful. You know, you see these old paintings of her, old pictures of her, and she's just a spitfire, you know. And
an amazing visual artist.
Yes.
And a writer and poet and an organizer.
Very, just energy, just boundless. You know, even when I saw her when she was in her mid-90s, she was still, you know, still revved. But she was brought in as kind of the young person in the organization of the Southside Community Arts Center. And she was representing the artists, and the other people were part of the Black business community, which was quite successful. You know, this is the Southside Chicago, Bronzeville, because of the amount of segregation involved, they really did the sense of entrepreneurship of developing businesses on the South Side was maybe more heightened than in a place like New York or some other cities, which certainly had it. But in Chicago, you had John Johnson is coming up at this time. There's a lot of, he was part of that circle as well. So Ebony, Jet, Negro Digest are all coming out of Chicago and what's growing out of the Black Renaissance.
And remember Negro Digest, which sadly ended relatively early compared to many other publications, was launched early on to be the intellectual, the cultural intellectual journal of Black America emanating from the South Side.
Right. Yeah. It's a great bundle of people. A lot of the pushback in the NAACP in the 30s comes from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Abner Harris, a lot of the more leftist positions that were pushed at in the broader African-American mainstream are coming from people from Chicago. So the Southside Community Arts Center, just to keep kind of rounding back to it, because it really ends up being a great connection with even Laszlo Moholy Nagy, mm-hmm. who I also cover in the book, who ran the Institute of Design, which is now part of IIT. He had been at the Bauhaus in Germany, and he comes here in the late 30s to restart the Bauhaus on the South Side. And his motto is, everyone is talented. It's all about making art, not just owning art or having art. It's about making it. And so it is the institute that does, they actually design and create the interiors of the Southside Community Arts Center. So there's a great, that was the kind of thing when I found that, I said, bingo, and that's what I wanted, to be able to connect these different parts of the city and different impulses together. And
you,
and the
you
South
can
Side
see
Community
some
Arts
of that
Center.
Wood paneling.
It's still there.
Inside, inside the house.
Yeah. I mean, they have limited programming and stuff, but it's still open and one can go see it. So, and in that sense, it's also one of the last pieces of what you see from that kind of high period of the Institute of Design and the kind of meaty mid-century modernism.
So interestingly, both wings, in a way, of the Bauhaus wind up in Chicago, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy with that early Bauhaus idea about creation, craft, hands-on, everyone an artist. Mies van der Rohe with the high modernism being capitalized, essentially, his own adult lifetime, hating each other, but both but working on the South Side.
Right. Well, they really are you can't take them apart. They're two sides of the same coin. They come from the same tree of modernism. They actually quote the same line out of Thompson's On Growth and Form about the seal being the perfect form. And they both quote this thing from this book, but they both are about space. You know, Mies is about creating space. They are both driven by many of the same impulses, but Mies is this top-down, Platonic kind of driven by spiritual things in a big way. You know, so he teams up with big business, with big government, and what he does becomes the face of the American corporate skyline. And that speaks to something about Chicago. You know, that big power, that make no little plans, they lack magic to stir men's blood, Daniel Burnham, you know, he spoke to that part of Chicago. And then there was Moholy, who was a craftsman, who it was all about the doing. And so that workshop mentality of Chicago, of our grandparents and great-grandparents who came from Czechoslovakia and Poland and in Germany, who made furniture, who made Chicago the center of the furniture industry and the arts and crafts movement in the United States. Those are the people that Moholy spoke to, you know, that kind of craft workers, the skilled unionist people. And so each of them kind of brought modernism to different aspects of Chicago. And it's a sad thing that they really weren't able to marry each other. What I've heard in kind of digging through papers and talking to people, the two things that were real issues that drove them apart was that Mies was very angry that he used the word Bauhaus. And you can see reading letters and the initial announcements of it that Gropius, Walter Gropius, who was the founder of the Bauhaus and Moholy had been his kind of right-hand man, Gropius gives him permission to use Bauhaus. He says, yes, go ahead and call it the new Bauhaus. Mies claims that the man who runs the director of the Bauhaus owns the word Bauhaus. And so he felt that when he closed it down, when the Nazis kind of got too into it, that he still owned the word Bauhaus. So it was a matter of anger on his part. So the other part why Moholy didn't like Mies was that Mies had been maybe a little too friendly with the Nazis for a little too long. He doesn't leave until 38. He kind of sends feelers out to say, you know, gee, you're going to rebuild Berlin and I'd be kind of interested in helping. And the word he gets back is, not only does the Führer not want you helping, but he doesn't really like what you're doing. And Mies leaves after that. Right. So those two things, and Moholy had been very active in bringing people out after he had left Germany. So those two things really, even though philosophically there were two sides of the same thing, personally, those issues really kind of got in between there.
Interestingly, too, and in a way that they do sort of marry posthumously, photography. They each have tremendous influences on one by training people and having the institute, and the other by finding people who can shoot his buildings and, and represent his space.
And the person who's right in the middle of that is Harry Callahan, who is a student at the Institute of Design, but he also becomes great friends with Mies. You know, Mies was, though he has this if you've seen photos of him, he's this great overbearing, you know, kind of German, looks a little bit like my grandfather, too much for comfort sometimes, right? But you know, after three or four drinks, he was quite friendly and I think had a happy social life here. And Harry Callahan is a terrific, terrific photographer who is influenced. He lives in Detroit, and he's a kind of a hobbyist. And Ansel Adams is someone who he meets, the great photographer Ansel Adams, and he convinces him to kind of pursue photography as a living. And he's brought down to Chicago to meet Moholy-Nagy, who, and there's a lovely Callahan describes when Moholy sees his work. And Moholy at this point is dying of leukemia. And he's in a place called Salmanok that's donated to him to use for summer classes. And Callahan shows him his photos, which if you've never seen them, they're black and white, the great preponderance of them. And they're just heart-stopping, you know. And his work in Chicago, what makes him truly a Chicagoan in my mind is he understands snow better than anyone else.
I was going to say, there is a picture that anybody, if they see the picture, who has not been here or from here, wouldn't say Chicago. And anybody from Chicago immediately knows it's three bare trees on Lake Michigan, and there's snow at the base, and you see that, and your heart stops.
Absolutely.
That's my home. That's my lake.
Please buy more copies of this book so I could someday afford one of those, because it's like, oh, no, that's too expensive. There's another one of his that I saw, a little collection. He had these, he would print like 2-inch by 2-inch ones, and I saw them all done as a four at, I think, the Corcoran in Washington. And they look like just little, almost little lines, like brush strokes on white. And then you get closer and closer, and you realize that they're those big old mesh garbage cans in the snow. And it's just, oh, my goodness. So Callahan, rounding back to when he meets Moholy, he shows him his photos, and Moholy just goes silent. And Callahan gets cranky because he's not talkative. He's a bit of a drinker himself, but very introverted person. And he's decided, he's very angry. Moholy hates his stuff. And Moholy looks at him and says, I have never seen anything quite as beautiful as this, you know. And he hires him on the spot. And he really is he and Aaron Siskin, who then comes in as another photographer there, become the core of a generation of photographers who come through Chicago, influenced by the Institute of Design, influenced by this kind of this last phase of Bauhaus, and are just magnificent. Roy Metzger, people like that. But Harry Callahan is also a good friend of Mises. Mm-hmm. I think they attract each other. They're both that part of Harry that was kind of spiritual. Every night he would leave his camera by the door, and he would get up before when the sun came up at 5:30, 6 in the morning, and wander through the city with the lights out, you know, with the lights just coming on, taking photos of the city. It was his spiritual practice.
We're speaking with Thomas Dyja, D-Y-J-A, author of The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream. Harry Callahan, Aaron Siskin, Arthur Siegel, Metzger, these people also act as bridges for another important intertwining that you take up in the book, and that is commerce and art. Chicago produces looks, and it produces those looks artistically and commercially, and they intersect in sometimes unlikely places, such as Playboy.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons why photography took off in Chicago and why there was this great flowering of art photography, because it was the center of catalogs. It was the center of commercial photography. Moholy Nagy only took it up as part of the curriculum at the Institute of Design because as the veterans were coming out of the war in 45 and 46, part of the goal of the school was to provide training for people to get jobs. It wasn't a kind of airy-fairy artsy thing. It was you learn trades here. And photography was easy to teach people how to do. And if they had a good eye, they could make a living with it. And so
you have Sears, you have Ward's, you have Spiegel, more and more.
Right.
And you have Donnelly printing all these things.
Right.
So this is a centerpieces of the Chicago economy.
Cuneo was the richest man in Chicago.
Right.
And this was a city with a lot of money. This was richer than the Crowns, richer than the Pritzkers. It was Cuneo, the printer. So this, you know, it wasn't just the fact that you were doing all that catalog work. It was all the magazines were printed here.
Right.
And so there was a lot of work for these guys. So they were able to make work, make a living, but then also pursue their art as well at the same time. And so that sense of serving art and commerce, it creates a tension, but it also makes things possible. And, and one of the themes of the book, I think, that I discovered, I didn't sit down thinking of it that way, was that tension between when do things sell out? You know, when do you move from the vernacular, that wonderful, cool, you know, gospel music on the South Side? You know, when does that become sell out? Does Mahalia sell out? Does Ray Kroc, who starts this great kind of first couple franchises that are wonderful, high-quality things for the family to do. They jump in the car and get hamburgers and look at a maid and all that kind of stuff. And when does that become McDonald's, you know? And it's easy to argue and say, oh, it's terrible. Everything gets, you know, finally sells out and is commercialized. But it's also a way to bring – how do you bring things to the marketplace and bring those values out there and still preserve that integrity? And you just keep seeing it throughout this period of people trying to do that. You know, the Chess Brothers taking vernacular black music and trying to get it out there. And at what moment does it kind of curdle? When does helping these people get their voices out become using those people?
Right.
And you just see that in many different forms during these years. But it's, you know, but that's also what creates this stuff. And so you can wish it away and say, gee, that shouldn't happen. But if it doesn't happen, nothing's happening.
Chicago becomes the center for the ultimate marriage, mismarriage, or failed, I guess, marriage is best of these things, and that's live commercial television.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, what many regard as some of the best things that have ever been on television are created and emanate from here. On the other hand, we've created a monster. Television grows and nobody wants that stuff.
Right.
Well, I'm condensing a bit, but talk about the Golden Age of television.
It was a special kind of television. One of the things, just as a preface, one of the things that I found was most interesting, which I did not know, was that radio was created not as its own thing per se, but everyone knew when radio was being created that television was coming. It wasn't like, I mean, when you grow up, you think, well, and then they discover television and alternative that. In fact, television was coming, and radio was really a kind of dry run for how they were going to work television. So the whole idea of networks and things like that was, how are we going to do television? Because they knew that that was the really big thing coming. And so Chicago is looked at in the 30s as a place to create cheap, innovative programming, because the things that are being produced on the East and West Coast cost a lot. So things like soap operas come out of Chicago. The National Barn Dance on WLS is really helps bring country music. It's before the Grand Ole Opry is kind of a ripoff of the National Barn Dance. So the Chicago has this history of radio as being a central place to speak to America. So when early television is out, there's New York television, which is kind of vaudeville, Broadway-oriented, Sid Caesar, very expensive to produce. In L.A., they're kind of working off of a film mentality, a paradigm, but the overhead's crazy on all these things. So they come back to Chicago and they say, we need some really creative, wonderful stuff, and by the way, you get no money to do it. So rather than being dismayed, the hardy workshop creative Chicagoans rose to the bait, I think, and use that improvisational theme that's very much a part of Chicago that you see at places other than Second City. And this is predates all of that. So shows like Studs Place that Studs Terkel did, which was, you know, kind of the original Cheers, a little beanery on the near Northwest Side, you know, which Studs called Shangri-La, a little cast of four people with very simple stories, but that are so rich and human and terrific. And then, of course, there's Kukla, Fran, and Ollie with Burt Tilstrom, the great puppeteer, and Fran Allison, who's kind of the Dorothy and Oz character, the interlocutor between you at home and the puppets, you know. And they create this world of the Kuklapolitans that gets fans like Tallulah Bankhead and Adlai Stevenson and John Steinbeck. And the third one that's really important is the Dave Garraway show, Garraway at Large. And Garraway, what he does that's really interesting is that he breaks the fourth wall, essentially. I don't know if we call it the fourth wall, but he gets a couple $1,000s to produce his show. And rather than pretending, he says, all right, we're going to take the camera around and show you the cameraman and the boom and the orchestra. And they became very famous for their special effects. But instead of doing that kind of Ernie Kovacs thing where you do he'd pour the milk and it would go up in the air and cut to something else, Gary would show you how it was done. They'd do a forced perspective down a hall. There'd be a little door at the end, and then he'd stick his nose through it, you know. Or they'd have people jumping off of a set, and the camera would go behind and show them landing in a mattress. It was in a certain way educational. It was entertainment, but it was also showing people how TV worked and how these things worked, which is so not New York, so not L.A., but consummately Chicago. And this all really happens within a space of – and all these shows, the other important point is that they're all improvised.
Right. There's no writers. There's no producers in the current sense.
The down part
there's
of that
scenario.
Is that they didn't have to pay the writers.
Right.
That was kind
of
one of the ways they saved money was by using these people's mother wit to create these shows every week. You know, so something like Studs' Place on Monday morning, they'd meet together and they'd have an arc, a one-page kind of outline of here's what the beats of this are, and they would then the rest of the week fill out the dialogue and fill out their parts and really create this show fresh every week. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, Burt Tilstrom, he was doing all the puppets, and Fran came along for the ride, and they developed this amazing rapport. One of the ground rules of being on that show was that you did not ever say that the puppets were puppets. They right. were. They existed. They lived. They had an announcer once who referred to that crocodile for Ollie the Dragon. He was summarily fired on the spot. You know, they had to be accepted as a world, and they did. And they improvised magical things.
And Burr and Fran couldn't see each other. Fran was talking to the puppets.
Right,
and they
exactly.
were talking to her. He was behind the
right.
puppet frame.
Well, the way when she was hired, she was on Breakfast Club.
Right.
And she wanted to, I think she was on, no, she wasn't.
No, she was on a Breakfast
Show. She was on Breakfast,
show.
She was at Breakfast yeah. Club with Don
right.
Freeman, whatever.
Right.
And that makes me seem much older than I am. I didn't actually hear that show ever in my life. But she came in and she was still a little leery the first day or two. And so Burr made sure that she was in the studio alone, and he had Ollie and Kukla start talking to each other and getting into some kind of really goofy argument about women and starting to say some really kind of provocative things, not sexual, but just
something
to kind of get her wound up. And Fran just turns and starts to yell and have this very heated argument with the puppets. And then she realizes
she's been seduced.
Exactly. And that she's now entered the world, and she kind of has this Satori moment that this is how it is, you know, right. that to live in Kuklapolitan world, this is what you have to do.
Fran Allison is also married to a guy who's in the record business and who's a song plugger. And this is for your next book. And he works sort of with and against the Chess Brothers. And they go to nightclubs every night because he needs to go there for his work. I'm blanking on his name.
Really?
He was Jewish. She was from a farm in Iowa.
Yes, he was.
And they went out every night, and every morning she had to report to NBC and be fresh-faced Fran Allison. But there they would be in Walter Winchell and Cup and Earl Wilson's national
right.
columns and so on. And then, boom, she had that.
Well,
so,
it's a very small world.
Yeah,
you know, the lines and the people that crossed each other. So in a certain way, it could be inbred. Maybe people knew each other too well in a certain way. But it also shot off great sparks. You know, one of the things that comes out of Chicago is recording. Bill Putnam has Universal Recording Studio out of Chicago, and it is the state of the art. You know, the soundboard that is used in mixing comes out of Chicago. And so you have a lot of musicians coming through, and it becomes a reason for everyone to be in Chicago. So people are connected. They know each other and are going to nightclubs and then doing radio shows and writing songs for people.
Right.
And
right.
it's a wonderful energy that's going on then.
You're listening to Critical Thinking. I'm Andrew Patner, 98.7 WFMT in Chicago and anywhere in the world, WFMT.com and WFMT.com/Critical Thinking for our always free Critical Thinking podcast. You also look at commerce and family and the good old word sin, how these are often sides of different things. You have the gospel singers and you have the blues singers. You have Ray Kroc developing what becomes a mega, mega corporation looking at the family. Mayor Daley's trying to bring people into the city. Ray Kroc says, no, they're driving out of the city.
Right.
They can drive to my drive-ins. Hugh Hefner is putting together from a very family background. I mean, he's coming out of a very...
Maybe too much of a
yeah,
family background.
Right.
That was the problem, yeah.
But at the same time saying, I'm going to have this kind of soft look at porn or female beauty or however you want to refer to it, but I'm also going to have political interviews, and I'm
right.
going to have fiction, and I'm going to give a lot of work to artists. Because
right.
we also, in addition to these commercial photographers, we're the capital or a capital of commercial art and commercial art schools.
Right. Well, I think one thing, unlike New York, unlike Boston, where these are cities that have been around for literally 400 years, you know, and people came there for a lot of different reasons, religious, you know, there's a whole list of reasons why they came. People come to Chicago and have to make a living. I mean, that is the major reason why people have come to Chicago over the years. And so it manifests itself in all these different creative ways, you know. And again, it is that tension. One of the things I wanted to get to, I'm a serious, deep lover of Louis Sullivan. You know, when I see the stencils, when I see the decoration on buildings, it is my zen, you know. That is, it just settles me somehow. I feel like I am home. It answers something in me. And what I think it is and why I think it expresses Chicago so perfectly is that it combines the natural and the man-made. When you look at it, it has these great leaves winding around, you know, forms of metal, right angles, things that are man-made. It's the perfect marriage. It doesn't oppose them. It unites them. And so many of these things you're talking about are about the yin and yang that Chicago really at its best times has managed, the pushes and the pulls, labor and capital. I mean, this is the city that gave you Milton Friedman and financial derivatives as well as the 8-hour day. And that's a pretty wide range of things. You know, the American Communist Party and Milton Friedman. I mean, that's mm-hmm. and they've managed to work here. And I think part of the reason why they've each happened is because of having the other side there. Yeah. And for me, one of the issues of the book was just that when we lost that, you know, 1959 begins these flights, the first regular nonstop jet flights between the East Coast and the West Coast. And, you know, obviously it's just a metaphorical thing. People have been flying coast to coast, you know, all the, for years and years. And there was already that communion between the two. But somehow in the national consciousness, being able to fly over became a regular part of business. And we lost that. Right. You know, we lost more than just this city in the middle. It meant losing a place where everyone came to. This was the convention city. This was the original Las Vegas. People came here to have fun from all over the country. And
from every background.
Right. And they still do, of right. course. But it really was.
But it was the place.
It was the place. Right. There was no Vegas. And, you know, and that's why
and
you
the
came
upper
here.
Middle class and the rich would come by train, stop for a day or two or three, and get on the next train.
By law, you had to. You right. couldn't go through the city. You right. had to change trains right. in Chicago. So I feel that we lost that. Yeah. We lost that mediating role of Chicago where when you came here, you had your feet in both parts of the country.
Right.
And so we need, my feeling is we need more Chicago in America to kind of bridge these two often, you know, these two sides of the chasm.
And we also started turning on our own history. So we had, yes, we had Louis Sullivan, but then we started tearing him down
well,
in the
we 50s. Did. Well, that was,
and then Richard Nickel is both an ultimate Chicagoan, coming from the city,
right.
learning photography, becoming obsessed with Sullivan and taking the pictures, and then dying in his attempt to save the buildings.
To landmarks. You know, he yeah. is a it, so again one of these double impulse. You have the Measy and Gropius. You know, let's clear out the whole near to south side and build Michael Reese and build IIT and scrape away what's there and build these marvelous new structures. Let's see a new America. But at the same time, then you get Richard Nickel, who is a Korean War veteran, kind of damaged, I think, by the war, living in his mother's basement. And he's at the Institute of Design. He's encouraged by Alfred Caldwell and as well Aaron Siskind to document.
Caldwell being the landscape counterpart
yeah,
to Mies.
Right, exactly. Mies. If you've ever been to the Lily Pool in Lincoln Park, that's Caldwell's.
Now fully restored.
Yes,
yeah.
a National Historical Landmark, a beautiful, beautiful thing. But he's encouraged to record, take photographs of all the Sullivans that are coming down. And he becomes, I think, literally obsessed with it. But it's the thing that brings him back to life. You know, Sullivan, there's something very enriching about it. You feel the life coming out of it. And it really brought Nickel back to life. And he ends up giving his life when the old Stock Exchange building is being torn down, which he tries terribly to stop. The effort that really got him in the limelight was the Garrick Theater in 1960, right. which he tries to save, but also known as the Schiller Theater, across the street from the Civic Center. And it's one of the inspirations for the Joni Mitchell song. They paved paradise and put in a parking lot.
And
it is now the site. It is the site of a parking lot. But that was the first grassroots preservation campaign.
Right.
Frank Lloyd Wright, there had been campaigns for Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, but they had been led by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Right.
So this
right.
is the first time someone else said, let's save these buildings. So you have, this kind of yin and yang. Let's build new, but let's start saving some of what we have here and what our patrimony is. So he was very much a part of that. And also Crombie Taylor from the Institute of Design. There were efforts to save things like the auditorium, which has been on the ledge 5-10 times in its lifetime. And thank God it's still there.
Right. And it's there for good at this point.
I hope
that's
so.
That's one place
really
we can feel.
I mean, that's like the Parthenon.
Right.
You know? Well, maybe we could have
sure.
a target there. You know, I mean, sure. it's our patrimony.
But also in this period, we need, quote unquote, expressways. And so we widen streets and okay, we won't tear that building down, but we'll just knock the entire lobby out, which won't change a hotel or a building at all.
There were one of the great buildings that was torn down by the Kennedy was they were able to go all the way around St. Stan's. That was a big deal to build the Kennedy. Mm-hmm. But one of the buildings that went down was Nelson Algren's Love Nest at Wabansia and Bosworth, which if you look at the map, they almost did have to make a special jog to take that out. So
let's talk a little bit about Nelson Algren. And another person who Chicagoans of a certain age will remember, fans of American literature of a certain period and some strange movie adaptations will remember, but who's been written out by the Brahmin historians of American literature. Chicago equals Sal Bellow, not Nelson Algren.
Right.
Len Dupre at Nelson's, the memorial for Nelson, which was at the Second City, and Len Dupre, Studs, Gwendolyn Brooks, pretty much everybody who spoke there gone. But Len that evening said, Nelson wrote about reality. He wrote about people in Chicago. If he'd written about faculty marital problems at the University of Chicago, he might have won the Nobel Prize.
That's
and
true.
He didn't need to name any other names.
Yes, that but did sort of
let's
say
Let's talk
it.
A little bit about Algren.
Yeah, Algren came to Chicago as a very young boy and with a kind of slightly crazy family, but he grows up on the South Side. And he is really, he is my favorite. I think he is the greatest novelist to come out of Chicago. And in that same way of Sullivan marrying the natural and the man-made, to me, Algren writes about utter horror with just great beauty. I mean, when he's on, it's a hard go for some people because it's very ornate. When you look at, say, Sullivan's later buildings, the banks in the Midwest with these heavily crenellated, you know, complicated designs, sometimes Algren's prose can go there. But God, it's good, you know. And Man with the Golden Arm is really a remarkable, remarkable book. Chicago, City on the Make. Anyone who lives here has to know these books. But he's very much a lefty. You know, he comes up, he's a communist. He is, during the 30s, kind of scrabbles around, very hard scrabble life, writes a book called Somebody in Boots. And when he comes back to Chicago, he gets involved with the John Reed Clubs and meets Richard Wright, who would go on to write Native Son. So he's very much a lefty, very much a communist, and remains so, you know. But he becomes active in Chicago. He writes a book called Never Come Morning that gets the Polish community basically stands up against them, and as the book is taken off the shelves of the Chicago Public Library, he goes off to war, and then he comes back and really hits the great moment of his life when he's writing Man with the Golden Arm, and he also has a great torrid affair with Simone de Beauvoir, the French existentialist philosopher who writes The Second Sex, which is one of the kind of fundamental books of feminism, and she begins it during her relationship with him in Chicago, actually. So they have this very torrid affair. And, you know, Algren, I think, ends up taking the split. You know, he's someone who loves – all these books are about the common man. They're about the rough sides of life in Chicago. Man with the Golden Arm is about an addict who comes back and tries to lose it and kind of go straight. And, Frankie Machine, the dealer, you know. And you can see the movie with Frank Sinatra. It is – okay, it's not very good, but
whatever it is, it's not the book.
Bears no resemblance, little resemblance to the book, you know. But by
and that's more Otto Preminger's fault than Sinatra's, I think.
Yes, no, Sinatra gave it, you know, his best. But I think Algren ends up being very disenchanted with the common man, you know, in a way that Studs Terkel stays with him. Algren is angry about the Rosenbergs. He led the committee for the Rosenbergs, and after they're executed, it's a kind of point when he leaves, you know, the racism that he sees in Chicago, he is really kind of disaffected about the common man. And so by the end of his life, he stops writing fiction by 55 and starts to really kind of retread the same stories over and over. And he becomes one of the leaders, I think we would say, of outlaw chic in a certain way. I mean, I think he's kind of proto beat.
It's like a Bukowski figure for some people at that point.
Yeah. And he becomes sad. I honestly have to say, I think he becomes a lazy writer. I mean, he sort of throws in, when he's on, he's just fabulous. He wrote a wonderful book, a very good book about Reuben Carter, who just recently died, called The Devil's Stocking. I mean, he never lost his commitment.
Because a woman told him once he was like a devil's stocking knit backwards.
he's, you know, one of the people I got to meet going after him was Art Shea, the great photographer, who is, I think, this city should, I hope they appreciate him. He's, I think he's turning 92 this month, 91 or 92.
Yeah, in and that he's range, just, right.
You know, he's a piece of history. And I hope everyone, he had a wonderful little show about his wife at the at Columbia College, I think it was, right?
Florence Shea.
And so he's just, he's like a last, one of the last links to that, still in Chicago and in Algren. So,
yeah. Algren and Studs, of course, were tight buddies and egged each other on through many adventures and experiences. Studs Terkel in Chicago. What's your take, Tom?
I mean, he is. You know, it's sort of a verb. You know, Studs is Chicago. I wanted to write a book that really took a 360 on everyone, you know. So even somebody like Mayor Daley, you know, who I don't agree with many of the policies, a lot of the things that he did.
And those who are new to Earth, Mayor Daley was the mayor from 1955 to 1975, Richard J. Daley.
Right, Richard the First, I think you should be known as, and Richard the Second, if we're going to, as long as families are now what we do politics now, you know, we do Richard the First. But he loved the place. You know, and you couldn't take that away from him.
Yeah.
You know, even though many of the things he did were out of a lot of bad impulses, God, the man loved Chicago. And so all these people, I wanted that. I don't think you don't have to be perfect to do good, important, interesting things. And Studs was the one person who I just couldn't find anything, you know, it was hard to find that other side. Every time I came across him, he was doing something that I just thought I really admired. And he was one of the connecting gels of this whole book, if not the connector of it all.
You really reinsert Studs into the history that he's been so excluded from by so many. And people get a chance to see how his life and his work runs through this history in radio, in television, in writing, in the people that he introduced and connected and ran around with, in his openness to all these different sides. And from Mahalia Jackson to architecture to opera to television and radio.
Well, in Chicago, it tends to have the sort of one person. There was Mies in the School of Architecture around him, you know, Burr and or the Jules Herbivore, who was responsible for a lot of that Chicago television, and the group of people who were around him. You'd get these small groups of people who kind of celebrated and worked together. And then you had Studs, who was connecting them, who was on the little boat kind of, you know, paddling between them all and making sure that they did all know each other and did actually come together at times.
You also have people that people either didn't know were Chicago or forgot that they were. And I think in many ways, the best perhaps to wrap up just this, it's almost a flyover of your book, but that's because we want people to read the book. The book is The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream. And we really have only touched on these stories and these people, and you'll have a chance to see more of these connections. And there are wonderful photographs as well in the paperback as well as in the hardcover. Well, let's listen to something.
There's no limit to the things that you can do.
Space is the place.
Space, Tom Dija, is the place.
It is the place. It's true.
Sun Ra. Tell us about Sun Ra and Cal City and Chicago.
Sun Ra was born Herman Blount in Birmingham, Alabama, and he was convinced that he had been abducted by aliens as a young man. A savant pianist, and he comes up after the war to get to know, tries to follow after Fletcher Henderson, the great band leader, who's kind of, maybe we could say, washed up in Chicago. He's at the end of his career. And Herman Blount begins to get involved, kind of closes himself up in his room, and because he has been visited by aliens, begins to read kind of Gnostic Egyptian magic and hermetic wisdom and all that kind of alternative occult stuff. And he forms a group called the Orchestra, kind of a cult around him. But he also develops this very rich philosophy that he types up single-spaced, all caps, on pages and hands out in Washington Park on the South Side, and would sometimes get into arguments with the kind of nascent Nation of Islam people. And so there's a question of whether there's a certain overlap, whether Sun Ra's ideas or Herman's ideas are helped influence Elijah Muhammad in that. But it's all kind of Afrofuturism about other planets and the relation between African Americans and black people of Earth and other civilizations. Not scientifically grounded, let's say. But he used music as this way to get to those spaces, you know. And so when you listen to Sun Ra, he changes his name eventually from Herman Blount to Sun Ra, which was signed by Richard Daley the First when he was county clerk.
Right.
It was a lovely thing in the University of Chicago where it's signed and approved by Richard J. Daley that Herman Blount is now Sunny Ra. But he used music to go into these spaces. And so during the 50s, when he's in the orchestra and leading it, they do standards. They do songs that are very and this is the time when bebop is still around. And this is the step after bebop. They're looking for these spaces in between. So they sound like, you know, listenable melodic music, but there's always a little off place. You know, they're going in different directions. There's a little beat there. And he did it as a spiritual study with the orchestra. He would say, we're gonna practice for 10 hours. We're never going to play a gig. You know, and they eventually, of course, did start to play. And in 59, they leave to go to Montreal and basically never come back. But
wind up in Philadelphia, I think.
Germantown. But he's really responsible for John Coltrane. Coltrane, before this point, had been playing sax for Miles Davis and was a terrible junkie, was known for standing on the stand and picking his nose while Miles was playing, which Miles did not like at all. And so one of Sun Ra's saxophonists brings him back, I think it's John Corbett, and brings him to Sun Ra, who starts to tell him this about the philosophy. And so kind of John Coltrane's sheets of sound, his whole kind of way of thinking that informs his music is lifted off and inspired by Sun Ra. And really it's Sun Ra who takes us to the leading edge of avant-garde jazz and kind of jazz as performance art.
And everything that happens after this book, I mean, with whether it's Coltrane, the AACM, Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, all of that avant-garde. And yet here it was, in part, as he is, well, I don't know what the word is, not tuning, but it's almost like training by playing endless nights in dance joints and strip clubs
constantly
in Calumet City.
It is, right, exactly. I mean, at the same time, he is also playing in Calumet City, which is where, even though you did have strip joints in Chicago, the ones in Calumet City were the real ones.
Real ones.
There was a lot more going on there.
Right.
And there was this huge concentration of them down in Calumet City. And so he would play nights there as well and just kind of go from. But the black musicians would have to play behind a sheet.
Right.
So they could not see the white women stripping.
Yeah.
As if they were, you know, the photos I've seen in Life magazine, I don't think they were that interested. But
yeah.
It was the sense I got in reading their testaments.
But there was that way that the hard work vision of Chicago, you go, you punch the clock, you work 10, 12 hours.
Right.
And that, in a way, both gave him something to move on from, but also gave him that 6-7 night a week discipline to then recreate music.
And again, you know, and I, you know, there's a kind of connection that I like to make is with him and Callahan. you know, who, as I said, would get up every morning and take photos. And I was lucky enough to meet Wayne Miller, who was a terrific, mm-hmm. very important photographer in Chicago for Ebony Magazine and had studied with Steichen and worked with Steichen, Edward Steichen, and did that great show, The Family of Man. But and ran Magnum, the great photography agency. But he went to see him one time, and there was just a big box of photographs. And if you've ever known photographers, they tend to be a bit anal about these things, about cataloging their negatives and their images and that sort of stuff. And there's just a big stack of images that he had shot. And he realized, he said, that was that Harry took photos to take the photos. He wasn't looking to sell them, to do with the action of doing right. it, you know, and that infuses so many things, whether it's Sun Ra or Harry Kellen. It's all about the doing. And right. Moholy, even though he's so little known relatively in Chicago, there should be statues to the man, because yeah. that idea of everyone is talented and we do art because it's something that humans do mm-hmm. Infuses all these artists. And, you know, we see that later in Andy Warhol, Keith Haring, both of them talk about Moholy, mention them right. as being someone that has kind of informed their art. So Moholy had a huge impact, and you see it. Either he spread it or he intuited it in the work of others coming out of the city.
Thomas Dyja, D-Y-J-A, The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream, now out in paperback from Penguin. And whether you get it in hardcover, paperback, or some computerized way, the photograph on the cover of both tactile editions is one that many Chicagoans and many younger folks who are Chicago interested will get a great kick out of as they see what was then the Palmolive Building and the Lindbergh Beacon atop it. And there aren't all of those boxy buildings yet behind it. It just gets to sit there behind the Drake Hotel on East Lakeshore Drive and shine that Chicago light in the air. Thomas Dyja, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you again about Chicago and your other forthcoming projects.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Music that we heard in the middle of our program today was from outer space. Sun Ra and his band from outer space, bringing us Space Is the Place. And interestingly, even though Sun Ra had left Chicago by the time that album was recorded and released, he actually had returned with his orchestra to Chicago to record that album in 1972 for Atlantic. We heard but a sliver of the title track, which runs 21 minutes and 15 seconds on the album. We'd like to thank Sun Ra. We'd like to thank Matt DiStefano for putting the program together with us and making it sound great. We recorded it actually in May 2014, and therefore we wish to especially thank the patience of and the man, Thomas Dyja. Tom Dyja, great friend of Chicago and WFMT. Thanks too to the Arts Club of Chicago, Danny Schulman, and Paul DeRica for making this program happen. Alpha Wood Foundation makes this program happen every week. Thank you, funder. Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com is how to reach me. WFMT.com/critical thinking is where you can hear this or any of our other programs on the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.